I think we're ready to start this session. I'm Jim Walfris, I lecture at King's College London, and I'm really pleased to introduce Eric Azon, who's going to speak on Blanqui then and now. Eric is the founder of La Fabrique Publishing House, which has produced a whole series of wonderfully engaged and combative, important, often controversial interventions on a whole range of topics. And Eric's the author of a number of books, some of which have been translated into English, most recently, I think, History of the Barricade, and also People's History of the French Revolution, The Invention of Paris, and Notes on the Occupation on Palestine. So Eric is going to speak for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion afterwards.
Many thanks for this presentation. I'm not sure I deserve all these kind words, but anyway. Oh, there's a sort of mystery in the person of Blanqui. How is it? How is it he's important enough, 130 years after his death, to have us gathered here in Kingston and to give rise to books on his life, collections of his speeches and writings? How is it? The question arises because by many aspects one could consider Blanqui as very far away from our current contemporary preoccupations, I mean political preoccupations. His political or military political activity as a whole was a failure. The secret societies he organized in the 1830s, though very, very carefully constructed, as Dominique told at the beginning of this morning, they led to nowhere. And his insurrectional attempts, they were not only defeats, but one could say they had no the slightest chance of success. For instance, he organized two insurrections in 1839 and in August 1870, at the beginning of the war against Prussia. Blanqui, with a few dozens of his followers, they stormed a fireman barrack on Boulevard de la Villette in Paris. It was a bright Sunday, and they hoped that in this very popular area, people would follow them. But nobody moved. And probably nobody understood what was going on. And that kind of adventure explains why, for Lenin, for instance, Blanquism was not at all a compliment. It meant insurrection led without sufficient explanation, without sufficient preparation. It meant aventurism and so on. I won't be long on that because I think you will speak on it this afternoon. But there was at least one very funny thing. In October 1917, when, as you know, Kamenev and Zinoviev fought against Lenin, blaming him for provoking an insurrection against the Kerensky government. They treated him of Blanquist. And today for us, I think, for me at least, Blanquist's insurrectional attempts, they remind us more recent events in which revolutionaries tried to stir up the people by provoking spectacular revolutionary actions. I am thinking about Brigate Rosse in Italy, Rote Armee Fraktion in Germany, or Action Directe in France. Of course, we cherish, we defend their memory. We defend also the very few survivors. But for us, they belong together with Blanqui the conspirator, almost to another planet. In these conditions, how is it Blanqui is such an important figure for us today? First, because of his personal behavior, not only for his courage, his tenacity, which made him spend, as you know, half of his life in prison, but also the way he built his character. If Joseph Beuys or Andy Warhol made of themselves works of art, one could say Blanqui made of himself works of politics. With his skinny silhouette, his white hair, black glove, black suit, all that forms a very special character, quite a symbol of revolutionary fighting. But more important, the opinions he exposed in his speeches and writings are really in tune with our contemporary ears. In Boulevard Blanqui, then the first name was Boulevard d'Italie, it was named Boulevard Blanqui because he died there. In Boulevard Blanqui, you know, in Paris there are blue plates indicating the name of the street. And Boulevard Blanqui, one has written, one can read, it's written on every plate, Homme politique. That was exactly what he despised the more. He had no respect at all for democracy. The quotation has been referred two times this morning, so I won't quote it. What is a democrat? An elastic word made of rubber. Okay. Two times is enough. He clearly shows what is hidden behind the cult of freedom, of liberty. In the same letter to Maillard, he writes, "What should the revolution involve?" The quotation were translated by Peter Howard and Mick, It explains what is good English. What should the revolution involve? The destruction of the existing order founded on inequality and exploitation, the ruin of the oppressors, and deliverance of the people from the yoke of the rich. Well now, the self-styled revolutionary Republicans or Democrats do not want anything to do with that. Blanqui warns against universal suffrage and the cult of deliberating assemblies. In 1870, after the proclamation of the Republic, he writes, "The immediate election of a National Assembly would pose a danger to the Republic. Consequently, we demand that the elections be postponed indefinitely." Postponed indefinitely. "And that citizens be sent to all the departments charged with the mission of bringing the democratic light." The 19th century has mounted on the stage of history a long series of these parliaments, the meeting places of greed, envy, and servility, which invariably congregate at the feet of those in power. We must have done with the disastrous prestige of deliberative assemblies. That is really something which is never said at that period. He despises all the most influential political, economic theories of his time, Proudhon's theories, which were prominent at that time in France, and those of Saint-Simonian, Fourierist, Positivist, as Peter told in this morning. He was against the determinist of the Positivist. All of them, he thought, declared war to revolution. Arms and organization. These are the decisive elements of progress, the serious means of putting an end to destitution, d'en finir avec la misère. He who has iron has bread. We bow down before bayonets. A disarmed crowd is swept aside, but a France bristling with workers in arms means the advent of socialism. In the presence of armed proletarians, all obstacles, resistance, and impossibilities will disappear. That is written from his prison in Belle. But, for those proletarians who allow themselves to be distracted by ridiculous parades through the streets, by the planting of liberty trees, by the honeyed word of lawyers, there will be first holy water, then insults, and finally grapeshot and destitution forever. Let the people make the choice. Concerning the future, after the victorious revolution, Blanqui leaves things open. That is a thing which is completely different from the idea of a potential dictator. Not at all, not at all. He leaves things completely open. He writes in the Critique Sociale, "So let us take care of today. Tomorrow does not belong to us. It is not our concern. Our only duty is to prepare for it, as best as we can, materials for its organizational work." These opinions, they were quite exceptional in Blanqui's time. You don't find something like that in Marx, for instance. But I think they are remarkably in line with the ideals of the revolutionary movements which emerge today all over the world. And that is why, that is the point by which Blanqui is our contemporary, why he belongs to us. Thank you.
Okay, so we have about 3/4 of an hour. Yes.
So Eric, it's good that you pointed out his opposition to democracy, goes to the point here. So there's really no surprise that the Blanquists would support Boulanger.
Did they?
They did.
Some of them.
Right. Because democracy was not at the heart of their enterprise.
It's true. Boulanger was, at least in the beginning, an ambiguous attempt. It was not clear. I think those that, like Rochefort were also Boulangiste, not a Blanquiste. Not at all a Blanquiste, Rochefort. But he was a Boulangiste. I think they thought it could be a providential man to get out the marécage of the beginning of the Third Republic. I don't remember which were the Blanquists, which were Boulangistes.
Well, in Zelf Sternhell, he goes so far as to say that the not only were the quarters of Paris, that had the most Blanquists were the most Boulangistes, and those that were also there was also a strong anti-Semitic tinge in those same areas. And we know that within the Blanquist movement there was some horrific Jew hatred.
It's an argument.
Gustave Tridon.
Oui. Tridon, he was the bras droit de Blanqui. Ce qui est intéressant, c'est que c'est le. He is the only one I read which makes an éloge des Hébertistes. Hébertists were really despised by the whole massively French history. Mm-hmm. Hébertists were. Tridon, he wrote a small brochure to defend their memory.
And Blanqui wrote the introduction, 1864, I think. Can I add two things? One about democracy, going to your point again, and another about the question of violence. Because you talked about how a France bristling with arms can assert itself. But on the question of democracy, my view on this is that Blanqui's not a democrat in the way that Rousseau is not a democrat, because he distinguishes sharply between sovereignty and government. So if democracy, as Rousseau says, is a form of government, like aristocracy or monarchy, that's the question of who undertakes the executive work of administration. And you can do that, in Rousseau says, utterly classical terms. That can be one person, in theory, with counselors, a king. It can be a few people, an aristocracy, or it can be everyone, a democracy. But it doesn't really, first of all, it doesn't really matter, because government is secondary. And the question of government is to basically do what it's told. And the real question is, who tells it what to do? And that's the question of sovereignty. And if an aristocracy is sovereign, well, then you live in a in a society structured around privilege and inequality. If you have popular sovereignty, well, you have what Rousseau is defending. And Blanqui solidly defends popular sovereignty, in my view. Where he's suspicious is how that is translated into administration and government. And so I agree very much that he sees again and again these so-called revolutionary figures or revolutionary Republicans or however they style themselves betray their mission and turn themselves into what's a scenario that'll play itself out in the 20th century into a kind of privileged new bureaucratic class, and he wants to cut it off at the knees. So in that sense, he anticipates points that Trotsky and many others will make, you know, vigorously all through the 20th century. But it's not that he doesn't, I don't think it's right to say that he has no respect for popular deliberation, although he doesn't talk about it a great deal. The thing that he says that it's our task is to eliminate the iron grip of the aristocracy in the church. We've got to get rid of the priests. You know, he says very forcibly, you know, literally march them to the frontier. You can make do with lots of things, but the aristocrats and the priests have to be taken to the frontier and put on a boat, you know, or just pushed out of the country. We can't work with these people. But as we talked about this morning, for what happens after that, how people will then deliberate and decide how they should govern themselves and so on, that we can leave to them because it's not our concern. So I just want to add that he's not a democrat in that sense, but he is a democrat in the broader sense of popular sovereignty.
Like all of us.
Like all of us, exactly. Who trusts the parliament? I mean, he has the same arguments that Rousseau makes. Who trusts a parliament that is elected every 4 or 5 years with its own corporate interests, at least on its own terms?
And he did run pretty regularly for office.
Blanqui?
Several, you know,
late.
In 1870.
Yes, he did late. I mean, that he thought, and he's not saying, he doesn't, so in the 1870s, when there is a kind of a republic, a sort of republic, he's not proposing to overthrow it. And in 1848, he doesn't propose to overthrow that either. He thought you could work with it, but you would have to take certain steps. I just wanted to add as a comment, really, but listening to you read that quote about France, hérissée d'armes and so on, you know, bristling with weapons and in front of armed proletarians, all obstacles disappear. And of course, you can think, well, that's simplistic. And I've often wondered about that quotation. But what it resonates for me, I've been doing some work recently on the Haitian Revolution. On the Haitian the revolution in Haiti or Saint-Domingue. And I also remember the quote that Marx refers to repeatedly of, when you get to a certain point, there will be a slave owner's rebellion. You know, when you get serious about democratic change or popular empowerment, you can be sure that there will be a moment of conflict. You know, whether that has to be open civil wars depends, in a sense, on the dominant class. But you will be confronted by all of the power of the established order, however they choose to use it. And the revolution of Saint-Domingue is the most extraordinary case that demonstrates that. But if you challenge a society at the very root of its power, you will be in an absolute fight to the death. And so in Saint-Domingue, for those of you who don't know that history, that's exactly what happens. The slave armies have to arm themselves to the teeth, turn the entire country essentially into an armed camp. And at that price, they can win. Very high price they have to pay. But anything else was suicide. There was no alternative, I mean, in that context. So I wondered, my question was, well, and you know, it's very striking to read that, to read about that history and how it was seen from both sides. Because it was clear the French were going to fight to the very last man to try and retain it. When Napoleon sends a vast army to reclaim it, he really means business. I mean, it's absolute butchery. And it requires very forceful resistance to overcome that. And I wonder, I suppose, for us, you know, is that something that belongs to a past that is forever gone? Or when we talk about revolutionary change, will we have to face something, hopefully not of that quality, but that question of how to address the question that was self-evident for all the French revolutionaries of popular empowerment through a prise d'armes, you know, that you would have to arm the people, whether that's literal or metaphorical, in order to be able to assert something like popular sovereignty. Do you think that today, for example, is that still a question that has any pertinence?
Do you mean arms in the literal meaning?
Well, I don't actually, because I don't think that would win.
No.
I think that would be totally counterproductive. but I mean something more than protest or resistance or demonstration. Finding a way, for me, this is one of the real questions that Blanqui leaves us with, which, how do we invent a new kind of force populaire, a kind of the political equivalent of an armed force?
Is it possible to have a precise idea of what must be done for that before the events begins? I mean, must we have to prepare it, particularly concrete in a calm period preceding the events? I'm not sure. I think events will succeed in preparing it or not, and it, of course, a lot of things depends on that. But I don't feel very Bolshevik on that point.
Mm-hmm. Just to finish up quickly, I'm struck that if you compare our period, so since 2011, say, with the exception of the Middle East, but in places like Occupy in the US, perhaps to some extent with the Nuit Debout mobilizations in France, certainly I think in other parts of Europe, there have been remarkable inventions and developments at the level of organization, but not really at the level of say, civil, of you know, massive or truly threatening civil disobedience. Or if you compare with some of the anti-colonial strategies or some of the civil rights movement work, I feel like we still haven't, we've got to the threshold of that question, but we are not prepared to address it. And that, I agree, we can't lay out a script, but until that question is, in a sense, normalized and discussed more frankly and directly, that the danger is what has happened, which is that we protest and we demonstrate and then we go home again and again.
The kind of situation in France today shows that what is going on is extremely unexpected. I mean that typically a reformist trade union would become from one day to the another a strong weapon against the law and good government. That was really unexpected. I'm not sure it's an answer to the question, but I think maybe maybe today would be a few weeks before we were in a flat land plane. And now we have jumped on a plateau.
Plateau.
Mm-hmm. We have not stopped to climb up the path upward, but the defect of hate won't be abolished. I think that is something which is probably more or less permanent from now. A level of conscious.
Yeah, you talked about that, like that how like they were kind of doomed to fail the insurrections, like. And I kind of understood that it's because, in a way, it was a kind of failure of organization from this kind of conspiratorial point of view, like that it's not, it was not like clear for the people, in a way, what's happening, let's say. But do you think that like in a way there is two kinds of organizations? There is the conspiracy. There is the organization of this conspiracy that kind of like tries to, let's say, kind of create this kind of vanguard. But like someone was talking about also about this like how to organize, what's the actual organization of the people when they are in the streets. You know, do you think that there is something there, like in that theory? Or because in a way, like the idea that like there is like in each block there is someone who is kind of like knows how to do something, you know, like is some kind of militant that requires a kind of neighborhood that is actually kind of politicized already. I'm just wondering because I'm interested, like what is the actual, let's say this kind of militant organizational like guidelines of Blanquism. Is there something there that like could kind of like counteract that kind of we demonstrate and we go home kind of logic that is now?
I think there's a contrast in Blanqui. There's a contrast between his obsessional organizational mind. The Société des Saisons, and even Instruction pour une prise d'armes, you talked about this morning. He explains how many pavé you need for building a barricade, and how you must organize them, and how you must make a defile of in arms in the streets. That is very, very, it's one Blanqui.
Yeah.
Not the most contemporary.
Yeah.
Not the more contemporary one.
Yeah.
And the other one, which is really, let's destroy the existing order without any precise idea of what we must do after. It's not going to work. Let's destroy, get rid of it, and leave the others, the youngest, our followers, to build their world. It's complete. It's there is a contrast between both aspects. No, Dominique.
Oui, je pense aussi qu'il y a ce qu'on oublie un petit peu son respect pour la République.
Back to the Republic.
Quelque chose entre les deux, malgré tout. On voit bien qu'en 48, quand la République est là, il n'appelle pas la révolution.
So in that moment in 1848, when the Republic is established, he doesn't call the revolution.
Voilà. Quand la Troisième République se met en place, il n'appelle pas non plus à nouveau quand il sort de prison, tout au moins. Et cette fameuse lettre à Clemenceau où il lui dit. Vous ferez la révolution de l'intérieur.
And the same in 1870, he again doesn't call to overthrow the Republic. He writes a famous letter to Clemenceau saying, you will lead the revolution from within. We could just add that in 1848, what his main activity is the Club Blanqui. So there is a work of organization in those months when it is possible, which is public and open and deliberative and very striking.
Some contemporary communist theory speaks of our own moment as having entered an era of riots. An era of riots.
Les émeutes.
It speaks of it as a sort of social phenomena that is at once, you know, not purely voluntaristic nor aimless, but that it is sort of grounded in particular determinations of the developing social antagonisms of this society that previous forms of organization could accommodate but can no longer, such as political parties or unions and things like this. So just generally, as a very specific contemporary phenomena, what can Blanqui say about sort of the phenomena of the riot today? And its role in the development of social mobilizations.
I think he would probably approve what's going on. And probably many of his followers will work inside the movement. So by that way, he would probably try to enforce it.
Mm.
During La Commune, Blanquists, there were not so many, but extremely important, extremely active. There were maybe a few hundreds. Combien il y avait de Blanquistes par la commune? 200-300?
Oui.
Pas plus.
Non, il y avait 7 mouvements entre 7 et 11. There were 7 between 7 and 11 who actually sat as members of the
government. Oh, yeah, not members of that. But active all over the city, a few, 2,000-3,000, hundreds, but extremely active. They gave its form to the communal movement by many aspects. So I think if there were a Blanqui nowadays. With a group of Blanquists, they probably should be very active.
Mm. Yeah, in that case, I mean, one of the things about the commune, I mean, the thing that Marx really brings out is the whole business of electing and being able to recall delegates and so forth. Given their opposition to democracy, I mean, how did this all fit? What was their attitude to the
Commune's
constitution?
Quelle était l'attitude des banquistes vis-à-vis de la question de représentation sous la Commune, étant donné leur opposition à la notion de démocratie?
When the Conseil général split in two, almost every Blanquist, whether the majority was the difference between the majority and the minority. The majority, when it was clear that the war was not being won. The majority decided to form, to constitute a Comité de Salut Public, and to give that committee, which never happened, but the majority wanted to have that committee be more. Directive more Jacobin, and the minority was not really anarchists, but they thought that a Comité of Salut Public will withdraw to the people their main role, and Blanquists were rather. All of them except Tridon. Tridon was in the minority in that split, in that partage. All of them, which were members of the Conseil Général de la Commune, were in the majority, which means you can be. I think Peter is right saying that when Blanqui says, what is democracy after all, a rubber words he does discard at all the expression of the popular will. It's the formal democracy we despise with him today. He has the same feeling as again, towards democracy than us today, I think. He's very our contemporary of that point among others.
But I'm thinking particularly of during the commune itself, which I mean, did, compared to anything else that was going on, was sort of ultra democratic. I mean, you know, what were the Blanqui himself was in prison, of course, at that point. But what were the attitude of the Blanquis to the actual democratic structures of the commune? I mean,
they participate.
Right.
There was. How many members?
Well,
12 members.
This afternoon, okay. But there were seven. Given the way the elections were held, there were 7 to 11 actual Blanquis. But what they did was they were housed. And we'll talk about it later. In the departments that you would expect to find Blanquis in, war and prosecution, the prosecutor's office, the Costa, he's got many bags. So that, and then the Committee of Public Safety was a Blanquist thing. Okay, going back to their love for the French Revolution. So they participated, as Erica said, participated fully. They were elected. Blanqui himself was elected in several, I don't know, small, Senate, etc. So they participated, and it was as the war was, as Eric said, was clearly lost, that their Jacobin instincts kicked in. And it was the members of the International who were the minority,
right,
and who threatened no longer to sit in the commune,
right,
if it became a dictatorial body.
Right.
But that was the only moment. Other than that, as Erica said, they participated just like anybody else. They put stuff up for votes. When they won, when they lost. But they made sure that they were in the places that a good Jacobin needs to be in.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to anticipate some of your talk too much, but the question of formal democracy in the commune has to be put in specific context. The commune was a state of civil war that was against the new Third Republic, maybe not officially constituted. And the Blanquists, I do believe, wanted to launch a first strike against the Versailles. And the commune decided instead to hold an election to make their revolution, quote-unquote, legal. And Blanquists were critical of that, and I think correctly, for the simple reason they had a very brief window when maybe, if we imagine, but probably not, they could have launched a first strike against a disorganized army. So, in that sense, militarily, there's a certain truth to, I think, what they were saying. In a state of war, are you going to appeal to the other side with proclamations or with canon? It's a very blunt question.
This will be, the debate will be continued. Doug and I had this 2 years ago. We continue with this afternoon.
Okay. If it was I really liked how you mentioned the sign on the for the Boulevard Blanqui in the 30th arrondissement. Because I also found it really funny, the description underneath was en politique. And it seemed that there was something quite nice about the way in which it seemed like there was a problem as to how you do categorize this type of figure. And that was a kind of reappropriation in the sense of we can just portray him as a politician, as you rightly say, in the sense that he would completely reject. But I thought there's like quite a funny, amusing tension between him as an actual, as a figure and the life that he lived, and the degree to which it seems hard to put a very neat definition on that and what they eventually came out with, which I thought was, I equally found it amusing. And I wondered more generally, broadly in terms of his position.
position or reception in France today, because precisely when the people I've spoken to, you mentioned his name in Paris amongst a kind of general population, he will be known solely for, well, the name will be solely known for the Boulevard Blanqui. So you say, oh, I'm working on, we're interested in Auguste Blanqui, people say, oh yeah, Boulevard Blanqui, but won't really know much beyond that. So I wondered what you thought about the way in which he's been forgotten, because this is obviously in an Anglophone context, where he's completely forgotten, but even in France, there's a strong degree to which he has been completely forgotten from the revolutionary tradition, the republican tradition, the socialist tradition, or ostracized at least to a certain degree. And I wonder what you kind of made of that and whether there was a kind of interest,
I think,
since you published the anthology or not.
All the revolutionary, French revolutionary movement of the 19th century has been deleted from memories. We published a book of Gustave Lefrançais, Souvenir d'un révolutionnaire. Lefrançais was a fantastic character. We took him by from nothing. It was impossible to find something about him or by him in bookstores, in memories. So I think Blanqui, he's part of that vast movement of suppression of 19th century revolutionary France. It goes together with a very, very special way of speaking or writing about the French Revolution. The French Revolution, it was quite difficult to erase it, to suppress it from memories. It's too large, but the Thermidorians who govern us since more than two centuries, they found if it was not possible to eradicate the memory of the French Revolution, it was possible to distort, to give another meaning to its history. I think in French there is a proverb, l'hypocrisie est le vice rendu par, et l'hommage rendu par le vice à la vertu. How could you say that? Hypocrisy?
So hypocrisy is the homage given to vice by virtue?
No,
perverse. To virtue by vice.
Yeah. I think that the way of in which history is currently distorted, revolutionary history is distorted, is that kind of homage.
Mm-hmm.
That the same kind of homage.
Now, Eric, as a historian of Paris, do you have any idea why, when, and how it came about that Blanqui got a street named after him?
No, it's clear. He, in the last years, he was very old. He spent his last year in a building almost at the angle of Rue des Cinq Diamants, on what was at the pit Boulevard d'Italie. And after his death, of course, after his death, the Third Republic, the radicals, they proposed and won to give his name to Boulevard d'Italie, where he lived his last years. And the building exists, but it is in that color, like you see, because it is an Hotel Mercure. But the plate is quite well written.
There's a Rue Blanqui in Saint-Denis as well.
Oui. In the suburbs, a lot.
A lot, yeah.
A lot. But, well, there is a Boulevard Blanqui. Nothing with the name of Robespierre in Paris.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
There's the metro that's just...
Not in Paris, right, Montreuil.
It's just across, and it was actually Jacques Duclos who got that metro station in Robespierre.
In Montreuil, a city slightly outside.
Did you want to ask something, or was it just about the... Yeah.
No, I just said that the metro yeah. Robespierre, but it's like the only thing because Robespierre.
But thank you, it's just across.
Yeah, in the shabby area. Yeah. I think it's quite funny. I was quite surprised when you said there were so many Boulevard Blanqui, because I wouldn't have expected that. I would have thought they would have considered him an anathema. So it's interesting they managed to get some. Yeah, because it's important about memory and.
These would be all the communist municipalities.
Yeah.
So.
But very contentious.
Sure. I'll perhaps just ask you something to come back to the situation in France today. So there are these major confrontations against the attempts to reform the labor legislation that have given rise to not just strikes and demonstrations, but the kind of permanent assembly in the Place de la République, the night assembly. What you were saying earlier in response to Peter reminded me of I think I read in an interview where you were talking about the notion of the vanguard being outdated and something that just exists in the past. So when you talk about the relevance of Blanqui today, for say the people demonstrating, is it that people should discard what Blanqui is most remembered for, the organizational obsession and so on, and look more towards the emphasis on the cathartic nature of struggle in the hope that organizational forms will develop out of that? Is that what you're...
I think the obsessional organizational part of Blanqui, what it's historically interesting, but it's not, it cannot be by no way a model for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is inspiring in his example is, well, of course, the courage, the tenacity, the aim always clear to the destruction of the domination.
Mm-hmm.
That is inspiring. He didn't change a lot of that. And I think that would be the main subject of this afternoon, so we shouldn't speak too much about it now, but the role of Blanquists during the Commune, that is interesting. Because they were really his pupils. Right? He was in prison, but they did probably what he had ordered them to do if he would have been there. So, but again, it will be an important topic this afternoon, so we shouldn't.
Yes?
Something did occur to me, actually, I'm talking about places where people remember Blanqui, because his tomb, Père Lachaise, which I visited many, many, many years ago, is near the Mont des Ferrets. And that used to be a place of the Blanquis to gather, didn't it? So does anybody go there now for commemoration? The tomb of Blanqui.
La tombe, the grave,
yeah.
Blanqui's grave.
Yeah.
There is a very beautiful gisant. How do you say a gisant?
I don't know. It's like a statue type thing, but I don't know.
His statue lying on his grave by Dalou. Dalou was a great sculptor. He's the author of Le Triomphe de la République, Place de la Nation, which is a splendid. But he was a communard, Dalou. And for that reason, they refused to have this statue, Le Triomphe de la République, Place de la République. They exiled it à la Nation, which is not the center of the city, and they put it instead. They put that horrible big lady, which is at the center of Place de la République. But the gisant, that statue by Dalou on the Blanqui's grave is very, very beautiful.
Perhaps bring it to a close.
Maybe just before we thank, I just wanted to say, so there's lunch outside. If you're not used to the campus, there are places to sit out in the courtyard there. It's a nice enough day. If you could wait for about 4 or 5 minutes, we've got a few extra things to add to the lunch table, but we just need to unpack them. So if you can hold off on the food for just a second, we'll get it ready. And if we can meet again at 2:30 prompt, so ideally really more like 2:25, really important that we start the next session right on time at 2:30. And if you're a speaker, if you could come maybe a tiny bit before that, I do want to try and take a photograph of all of us together before people